Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Today, we welcome back to the studios of CBS Interactive, Fleischman Hillard's VP of Digital Media, Scott Rohde.
Hi, Tim.
And newly appointed Mumbrella Deputy Editor, Robin Hicks.
Hello, Tim.
This week, Ten's shake-up continues as James Packer leaves the board and Seven's James Warburton is named as CEO. Talking tourism from Victoria to the NT. Group buying sites. Will it work for media? 2.5 headaches. 9's scheduling shambles. And meet CommBank's online family. Now, we start today by welcoming new Mumbrella Deputy Robin Hicks, previously from such marketing titles as Media in Asia, which is now known as Campaign Asia, and Campaign in London, which is still known as Campaign, and also Media and Marketing Europe. So, Robin, it's pretty harsh to throw you straight into the podcast, having been in the country for less than a week. Obviously, people will welcome yet another English accent on this Australian media podcast. So now two English voices, a Scottish voice and an occasional Australian voice. Alice, who produces the podcast, will join us in the conversation from time to time. So a tough question, early impressions of the market?
Well, I'm only 3 days in, and I just like to compare how I felt when I first got to Singapore, Asia, 4 years ago. When I arrived in Singapore, I expected a market bristling with great print work. They'd seem to do very well at Cannes. Obviously,
scam ads, though, did you later find?
Well, that was it. The only time I used to see these beautiful print ads was in obscure magazines the month before awards season. So, and also when I came to, just before I got to Australia, I'd spent a bit of time speaking to regional CEOs. And they pitch Australia right up there with Japan and indeed Thailand for quality of creative work on the media and creative side.
And that's across all mediums or?
Across all media, yes.
See, I'd maybe argue, and it's possibly too early to say, I would argue that we're weak on print at the moment. You know, I can't remember the last time I saw a really, you know, consistently great big print campaign that was print driven, for instance.
Right. Yeah. Well, I spent a bit of time looking through some TV commercials. Obviously, I expected perhaps a higher standard than what I've found. The most played ads I've had a look on Mumbrella, the likes of Quilton and Franklin.
Franklin Supermarkets, our turkey of the week this week.
Supermarket sing-alongs, indeed. But I think the reality is that vanilla most played level is pretty much weak the world over.
See, one thing I wonder, because you always realise, you know, as you sort of come into a new market, you're on a bit of a diplomatic tightrope when people say, what do you think of the work? And the one thing that occurred to me, and this was having worked in the Middle East as well, is proportionally, it's a smaller market, so it's, you know, a third the size of the UK, for instance, which I've written about before. I would say proportionally, the proportion of really good stuff and really terrible stuff is the same. And it's just that in any market, most stuff is somewhere in the middle.
Yes, yeah, perhaps so. I mean, the only market that I've been that the stuff is great is Argentina. I spent a few days in Buenos Aires. The work was absolutely extraordinary.
Are you saying you put a challenge out there to the creatives of Australia? They need to up their game at the moment?
Yeah, perhaps take a look at the reels of Buenos Aires agencies.
They're and that's genuine work that's getting mainstream runs.
Yeah,
that's
switching on the box and seeing what's about and flicking through magazines and newspapers. It really was of a consistently high standard.
I think, I guess the comparison that always gets made sort of locally is Australia and New Zealand, where New Zealand tends to sort of, you know, for its size and the size of the agencies, tends to sort of overscore at things like Cannes. And someone described it to me as because it's a small enough market that you're talking to the boss of the company, you know, for the creative directors, they described it as for creative directors like playing tennis without a net, because you have a big idea and you can almost always get it bought and get it signed. And I just wonder whether that makes, you know, actually makes quite a big difference in the work that we see.
Yeah, perhaps. And I also wonder whether how much attention regional CEOs play to Australia. And they tell me that they talk a good game and say that it does is a leading light in terms of creating creative standards. But how much time do they actually spend here? Do they look at just the award-winning reels, or do they spend a bit of time looking at TV and ads?
And media you've consumed so far?
Well, as soon as I got here, I had to flick through the Sunday Herald, right, on Sunday, and then
which is the Fairfax paper.
Yes, and I've had a dip into the free sheets because I'm from London, spent a bit of time there. So it's interesting to compare, say, Metro to MX.
Yes, so MX is the News Limited owned one. Metro in the UK is owned by Associated, isn't it?
Mirror Group?
Yeah, no, I think it's. I think Mirror Group may have a small stake in it, but sort of driven by Associated, who of course indirectly own half of DMG Radio. What is your impression in MX in comparison to other free sheets?
Well, it's certainly very gossipy and a colourful read. And I certainly enjoyed reading City Morning Herald, but I think that it was just it felt like a breath of fresh air having being forced to read the Straits Times, which is Singapore's flagship newspaper, which is obviously government run, to read a newspaper that's independent and there's a bit of free thinking and can actually have a go at the politicians that serve the country. So that's refreshing.
Yeah, one thing with
tried the Daily Telegraph yet?
Not yet.
You're in for a treat.
Yeah, I don't know. So you're being a bit harsh because my sort of reading habits. Are, I mean, I read all four of the papers that are we're in Sydney, obviously. So on the daily basis, the two local ones are the Herald and then the Telegraph, which is the tabloid, and then national ones, the Finn and the Australian. I would choose to read the Telegraph first of all. I think you're just being a bit snobbish about tabloids.
What do you mean snobbish about tabloids? Come on. Don't start me, Tim. My background's in tabloids, for God's sake. I don't mind them at all.
Is your problem that it's not tabloid enough?
I just think it tries to sit as far too one-sided as my actual real issue with it. I mean, it's
unlike the Sun that you used to work on.
Well, I never denied it was. That's one of the reasons I stopped working there. I didn't enjoy that. But I think that the Telegraph, I just find to be. I don't know, it just feels like it's missing something. It sometimes wants to be the Sydney Morning Herald, other times it wants to be the Sun, and then it seems to straddle in between. Something to the SMH.
Yeah, but don't forget, though, the difference is, and I think this is the danger that we all fall into, is trying to compare Australia's publishing market to the British one.
Totally different. You're talking about markets such different size.
Well, it's not those. It's not to me. It's not so much size. It's the fact that in the UK you've got several national papers, of which you've got down market, mid market, up market. Whereas here, of course, you're talking city papers. So you actually have to try and appeal to a much wider spread of the population. So in some ways, I'd say like Australian newspaper publishing is maybe closer to the American model, where each major city maybe has got two papers. Next, Ten's new boss.
So it doesn't seem to be a normal week in media lately if Ten doesn't make a change to executive team. And while last week was all about Blackley and Murdoch, it seems this week it's time for the James Show in Packer and Warburton. There's no word as to why Packer's left yet, but it does seem there'll be a position on the board for Warburton, who's of course come over from Seven. Tim, a big surprise?
Yeah, and firstly, I suppose as we record this podcast on a Thursday, we're just beginning to get the first dribbles of maybe why Packer left the board. So the one or two papers reporting that the suggestion that there was an unofficial truce going on between James Packer and Kerry Stokes, who owns or dominates Seven Media, which goes right back to when Stokes took a stake in Consolidated Media Holdings, which is Packer's other media investment. And it seems they kind of had a gentleman's agreement. They wouldn't, go after each other's turf. So perhaps Packer decided that nicking Stokes' most senior salesperson was a breach of that, and Honor would be satisfied by stepping down from the board. And it looks like it was actually Lachlan Murdoch, who's another board member, who kind of led the poaching. So it's good. He's got some recruitment skills as well. So if ever things don't work out, I'm sure he could get a job at a recruitment agency instead. So now obviously, the big challenge for Warburton is stepping up from just running sales. And in Australia, that's probably the single most important skill to have when you're running a TV network. And that that was Blakely's background as well. But can he get his head around the other things, the scheduling? And obviously there are big questions for Tim with that scheduling, with you know, with the 2.5 hour sweep of news each day not bedding in yet. Interestingly, this week the other thing was Ten have been bleeding ratings at 5 o'clock on Saturdays and Sundays since they ditched the 5 o'clock news back in late January. Nine nipped in and did a 5 o'clock news instead. Six were getting hopeless ratings with their Ten were getting hopeless ratings with their new news at six. So now
Channel 6 was there.
Yeah, absolutely. And Channel 6 doesn't exist yet, fortunately. But yeah, so now now they've decided they're going to have both a 5 o'clock and a 6 o'clock bulletin on Saturdays and Sundays. So with everyone saying, oh, the 2.5 hour sweep of news each weekday isn't working, here's another half an hour of news on Saturdays and Sundays as well. So that's interesting. So that kind of certainly suggests they're not retreating from the, from the news strategy, which, of course, you know, was the suggestion that with Blakely being fired might be what happened.
From what I've read, Warburton seems very highly regarded. Do you guys think that he's up to the task?
Yeah, I mean, talking to one or two agency bosses, for instance, I talked to Barry O'Brien, who runs PhD, earlier this week, and he was very positive indeed. And it's one of those weird things, because for the networks, they and the media agencies are almost in perfect equilibrium. You know, everyone looks after each other and does each other favors, but at the same time has to do business and get good prices. So you do understand why all of the media agencies are saying very positive things. But at the same time, he's going to have a tough time because he was quite good at his job at Seven, and it would appear has just taken a chunk of Seven and Nine have both taken a chunk of Ten's business. And because agencies tend to sort of commit their spending, you know, at least 6 months, sometimes a year ahead, that means that he's going to have a tough time now clawing it back when he gets to 10, which won't be until July that he starts anyway.
Well, he's certainly been very well paid for that.
Very well paid, 2.2 million plus 50% bonus, performance bonus.
Could rise to 4.4.
I saw the 4.4 figure. When I read the announcement to the ASX, I read it as 2.2 plus 50%. But I have seen a couple of papers report 4.4, but I'm not sure whether they just weren't very good at maths and thought that 50% added on to 2.2 was in fact at 4.4 rather than 3.3. But if you're earning 3.3 or 4.4, probably not the biggest problem in the world.
Yeah,
I think that helps pay the bills at the end of the week, really.
Yeah. I wonder how that salary compares to other his equals of equivalent.
Well, we know that. Well, I can only figure that where he was before paid him less, which is probably why he moved. So I think we can assume that role pays maybe a little bit less.
I mean, I think there was that, but there was also just he sort of made no secret that he wanted to be a CEO. Yeah. David Leckie at Seven, not going anywhere. Just been sort of made, you know, sort of CEO, likely to be the CEO of this new merged Stokes entity of the Seven Media Group and the West. So you know, you can see why he took it. But, you know, it's a big job. I mean, talking to a recruiter just before the announcement on Friday night, he knew what was on offer and he was clearly impressed by the size of the salary. Yeah. So, you know, I think he thought that we might even see someone come in internationally. But the problem with that is you don't know the market, you don't have the relationships, and that can be kind of a killer at that level. You know, you can't afford a quiet year when you get up to speed.
Next, talking tourism.
So Tourism Victoria has called a pitch on its advertising account and is looking for both a lead and a boutique agency, as they describe it. And it has already said it's going to keep its existing You'll Love Every Piece of Victoria positioning, the kind of the famous jigsaw. And also on the tourism front, Tourism Northern Territory has launched a new $1.4 million campaign for the Red Centre. Scott, Victorian advertising, it's tended to be of the various state level tourism organisations. It's kind of the prettiest advertising.
I've always enjoyed their stuff, actually. It's always made me go, oh, I should really go visit a little bit more than just Melbourne whenever I'm down there. I always find New South Wales, you know, I don't really find they really hit the nail on the head sometimes. One of my friends works there, so better shut up. I really didn't like the Northern Territories one. But one thing I would say, your story reported and showed the video, or showed the advert, but I felt as though it was lacking what else they're going to do. Because you went into this whole thing about how it's an integrated campaign, it's social, it's online, it's offline, and I didn't know what else they were doing.
You chatted to Entebbe, didn't you?
Yes, early on this morning I had a word with her. The marketing director of tourism at Northern Territory, and she's very much said the campaign is about focusing on how a visitor feels when they get there, rather than just the tourism attractions, the sights and the scenes. Which also I thought that was strange about the Victorian campaign, that it is a beautifully shot ad, obviously very high production values, but
this is the most recent one, the Leader Double Life in Daylesford one.
Yes, yeah.
Which we should mention, picked up, I think, maybe half a dozen sort of the minor gongs at the awards last Friday, actually.
Yeah, right. So it's mysterious by the fact that I wasn't given a tour. I wasn't given a sense of what Victoria's like as a destination, which I thought was quite interesting. And yeah, the marketing director has said that's very much what they're going for, how you feel when you get there.
This is tourism into.
Yes.
And my one question on it, and this is something that did sort of crop up in our comment stream, was it's shot very much almost as a series of stills put together, you know, sort of and kind of almost animated. Which a few people saying, well, it made me feel slightly nauseous. Do you have sympathy with that view?
Yes, I do actually.
It felt a bit spinny, didn't it, at times? Especially the camera shot where it pans down with the sunrise coming up. I thought that was a bit unusual. The way it twisted or something, but yeah, it made me feel a little bit queasy. Yeah.
Now, at this stage, let me just bring in Alice Terlikowski, who is our producer on the podcast, but also writes on our sister title, Thumbrella, which writes about travel and hospitality. Alice, you I guess, are bombarded with tourism messages every single day.
Yes.
What are your impressions of where we're at the moment?
I've got to say, with Tourism Victoria, I think certainly the whole "you'll love every piece of Victoria" has certainly resonated within the industry as a very strong message. Just even down to just the logo, the Victorian map, all in jigsaw pieces, it resonates. People recognise it.
Which has been there for years. I think it was actually Sean Cummins who originally came up with it. I think so. I couldn't swear it, but I think so.
Right, okay, yeah. And so from an industry perspective, as well as a consumer perspective, it's recognisable. In terms of their Daylesford video, you know, someone was saying it's like, oh, I think I can go to Daylesford to get baptized or something like that. But there, you know, there may not be anything else to do there. I think it's effective, but what they're actually going for, what message they're trying to send about Daylesford in particular, I'm not quite sure.
Well, this is the funny thing. I still have no idea where in Victoria Daylesford is or what I can do when I go there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking as a consumer who doesn't know Daylesford.
Exactly.
You can always look it up.
I could always look it up, but, you know, it's kind of the ad's job to make me want to do that.
Go there.
Or I'd argue. Robin, in comparison to sort of, you know, regional level campaigns and positioning, I guess you've probably been exposed to a few kind of country level stuff out of Asia.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting. On the in Asia Pacific, obviously, there seems to be a spat of sort of, well, there's been a tradition of sort of lazy superlatives slapped on at the beginning of tourism campaigns. You've got incredible India, amazing Thailand, uniquely Singapore, Malaysia, truly Asia, etc.
Dangerous Libya.
Yes, yeah, no, indeed.
Don't go Syria.
But as irritating or perhaps bland as they are, they are memorable, and I do wonder how. Say the Victoria campaign or Northern Territory campaign feeds into the national campaign. How well do you think that works? Do you think it does? Do you think it does tourism Australia a lot of favours to have these disparate and perhaps fractured campaigns going on at state level?
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? And the big question then is which is their primary audience? Is it an Australian audience or is it an international audience?
Yeah,
and you certainly get the sense that that this campaign feels to me like. You know, it will do better within Australia, but it doesn't feel part of a big international campaign for Brand Australia.
And they've been they haven't hidden that in there with the Red Centre, the Tourism NT campaign. They've come out and said this will be a domestic campaign, so that they're looking to target people who are already here, if not Australians. Mm. So they can't in one 30-second TVC, you can't capture. Every single visitor you want to come to that region.
Well, next, will group buying sites work for media?
As we discussed on last week's Mumbrella Cast, group buying sites are popping up everywhere. And what we've seen since then is the launch of Little Birdie, which is the first to focus on the media sales sector. Basically, their principle is to sell media space for a substantial discount. So, Tim, do you think it'll work for this sector?
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting one. So one of the people behind this is Sam Tanous, who used to be the editor of Ad News, so well known to, I'm sure, a fair few people within this industry. Thinking being group buying, principle is get together a large group of people, give them an amazing discount. So long as enough sign up, everyone gets the discount. The vendor's happy because they've got a bulk of business they wouldn't have got otherwise. The buyer's happy because they've got a bargain. The site's happy because they take a clip. So the question here, I think, for Lil Birdie, which is L-I-L-B-I-R-D-I-E, if you were wondering, is will media owners actually give it a go? And not just use distress inventory. They're very keen that it's not about distress inventory, that it's actually, you know, just sort of opening it up to new advertisers. Now, if there's a risk for them, it's that media owners find that advertisers who would have advertised anyway grab the cheap space and, you know, they've lost revenue they would otherwise have had. So that's the sort of risk for them. But obviously the upside is, you know, if you can print, you know, a magazine with 20 pages of ads rather than 5 pages of ads, then even if you've given a big discount, then it's worth doing. So I don't think it's a dead cert, but if I was them, I'd be giving it a go because it's a good idea. They're the first to market, and now it becomes a question of how good they are at selling themselves.
How quickly do you think it'll be till another 50 of them turn up, just like the coupon buying ones turn up?
Well, it's a very narrow niche, isn't it? And that's the thing. Narrow. So you need to have relationships with the media owners. You need to, you know, understand how to reach the industry, you know, the audience of media buyers. So my suspicion is we won't see anybody else rushing to launch until they either made it work or not.
I think if it's successful, there'll be others trying to jump on it. I think it's a good idea. I think it's got a lot of potential. Good luck to them. I still think the name's a bit crap, but that's just me.
Interestingly, it has been tried in the past, or something similar has been tried in the past. I was reading the comments to our story when we first wrote the news, and there have been difficulties. Oversold inventory is one that's commentator note, and also choke points in production scheduling.
Yes.
And where you think, well, that could be a spanner in the works further down the line.
I suppose it depends on the medium in question, doesn't it? I guess if you're a magazine that's used to printing a book that's 42 pages and you've suddenly got to do a 96-page edition, then that can put a bit of stress on the team. But there again, you know, I kind of remember when I, you know, long ago when I had a magazine called Hospital Doctor, we, depending on where we were in product cycles, because it was mainly pharmaceutical advertising, we would go anything from a 28-page book to a 96-page book, you know, up and down. And you just flog the staff and they get it out, you know. So it'd be a great problem to have, I guess, for a lot of media owners. So I'm not sure that practical issue would be anything more than a good problem to have.
Yes, and our friend James Tuckerman to Ant Hill.
Yes, so Australian Ant Hill. You chatted to James this week because they've launched Ant Mart.
Yes, that's right. One reservation, or not reservation, one obstacle he foresees is it's obviously the business of...
Who is he aiming Ant Mart at then?
The small to medium-sized, the fast-growing business sector. It's obviously more complicated than selling restaurant meals. But he really does think that he can make a go of it.
And for instance, his first offer, I think, was a course on using Facebook for marketing or something like that at a discount. And quite interesting that, you've got a media owner who's kind of trying to diversify the revenue stream as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It very much seems to me an entrepreneur from my first chat with him. He really does think that he can make a go of it. It's very early days. It's just beta testing at the moment. But the response so far has been good. He's had 20 advertisers want to advertise around the medium.
Now, I must admit, I'm slightly cynical about this whole beta thing. And I know he made a big thing in his posting about how it's beta. For me, I do think sometimes people use beta as their get-out-of-jail-free card. Call it beta. No one can criticise us for anything.
Gmail ran for, 4 or 5 years as beta? Until they actually just said, it's okay. And then obviously this week they lost... 100,000 people's email accounts. So, you know.
Oh, I missed that. Did they?
Yeah.
Were you one of the victims?
Thankfully not. I went and checked right away, and I was like, ah, good, I'm safe. But I think it was only 0.02% of their overall users or something like that. But yeah, there was some kind of bug in the system, and yeah, 100,000 people's email accounts gone.
And did they come back?
Gone.
You're joking.
No.
Missed that totally. Missed the story.
Wow.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all of the stories we've been talking about, you can go to mumbrella.com.au. So after Charlie Sheen's somewhat colourful personal life forced CBS and Warner Brothers to end production on the current season of Two and a Half Men, Nine's rating woes have continued, with not one of its shows on Tuesday reaching the psychologically important 1 million viewer mark. So the question is, where can they go from here? And let's just hear a little bit of Charlie Sheen in action.
The goddesses, Alex, the goddesses, let me just say this about the goddesses. I don't believe the term is good enough. But when you're bound by these terrestrial descriptions, you must use the best choice available, right?
Yes.
So if you think about it, dude, it's like I'm 0-for-3 with marriage, with nary an excuse, but like in baseball, the scoreboard doesn't lie, never has. So what we all have is a marriage of the heart, of the hearts. And I, you know, to sully, to contaminate, or, you know, or radically disrespect this union with a shameful contract is something I will, yeah, you know, leave to the amateurs and the Bible grippers. The Bible grippers. And then I just got to add this. There was a whole firestorm yesterday about Brooke being, you know, a part of our crew. And this, let me just say this. This is all I'm going to say about it is that where there were four, there are now three. Bye-bye, Brooke. And good luck in your travels. You're going to need it badly.
So, Scott, Charlie Sheen has been one of the big media stories of the week.
Absolutely. And funnily enough, the day before this podcast was recorded, he set up a Twitter account. I was reading an article about it, actually, where he got in contact with a company that actually do a lot of Twitter information for the likes of Kim Kardashian.
Because my first surprise was that @CharlieSheen was available.
So it wasn't, actually. It was actually somebody was domain squatting on it. And Charlie Sheen's team got in touch with another company and said, look, you know, we know you deal with these accounts. They had friends at Twitter. They went up to him and said, look, Charlie Sheen wants to get involved in this. He wants to talk to his fans directly. And they so Twitter, who don't actually verify really accounts anymore, they don't have a team that work on it, but they jumped on it straight away.
Verified is when you see the little tick and that says to people, this isn't someone pretending to be the celebrity. Yep. We've checked, it really is them.
So he got the account up and running, and you know, he's sitting, I think, at 950,000 followers in a day.
Is that the fastest growth ever?
I believe it is. I mean, it took Ashton Kutcher 3 months to get from to 1 million, basically. So yeah, this is slightly faster, which just goes to show you in 2 years the difference. The other thing is, like, his first image that he put up onto TwitPic, I think, has over 1 million views already. And it's just a picture of him holding up a chocolate milk, saying, winner.
With a friend.
With a friend. Probably a porn star, let's be honest.
That seems now, to be funny, what his taste is in.
I started a new blog yesterday called kiltforhire.com, where I'm just kind of using it to talk about this. But I spent the first post talking about Charlie Sheen and the kind of girl involved in the St. Kilda scandal, because, you know, the both sides of the Atlantic, they're very similar type stories of these people who are going through this, you know, obviously some kind of turmoil in their life, but it's this media circus wrapped around them.
So the girl in the St. Kilda scandal, this is the one, she's 16, 17. She's made all of these allegations about St. Kilda footballers, some of which have proved to be true. Big media suppression orders on being able to name
her. But her family have kind of walked away from her. You know, she seems to be very lonely, similar to Charlie Sheen, although he's surrounded by porn stars and coke and hookers and everything. He does seem like, you know, he's lost his kids.
Well, I guess what we're talking in both sides is the two damaged people.
Yeah, and yet it's, you know, in this whole media circus wrapped around them, which at times feels kind of wrong, and we're all complicit involved and wanting more information about it. But on the same side, I think, you know, there has to be a point where we all walk away and say, look, let them fix themselves or somebody help them.
Brand image, brand Charlie Sheen. Is that savable, Robin?
Well, I, my first impression of Charlie Sheen was when I watched Platoon many years ago. So he emerged from a helicopter, very baby-faced and innocent. And then obviously there's Wall Street, Hot Shots, many other films followed. And he obviously had a strong brand image. But I do wonder, I was going to ask, which brands he's sort of attached to. Does he have any endorsement deals? Are they under threat?
Well, chocolate milk, by the looks of it. Right, yeah. That twit pick.
Chocolate milk and porn.
Right. But obviously, you know, the cliche is any publicity is good publicity. I just wonder whether any brand would take it.
Do you disagree with that?
I disagree with any publicity is good publicity. I really do. I think that's been shown that's completely untrue. I think it's funny because obviously the Bonds scandal's kicking off today as we're kind of talking about it, and they were running a competition for children, and a lot of people got
this
on.
This is here in Australia. This is the Bonds Facebook competition.
Yeah, and they were, you know, asked people to put in their Bonds babies, but then, you know, one woman put up a picture of their child, and somebody,
it was Eurasian, I think.
Yeah, somebody commented, "This is Bonds Australia, not Bonds Asia," and then another one said that, "Oh, your child's got a face only a mother could love," and there was some real.
It was quite nasty.
It was really bitchy.
And the thing is, it's made a big story, and not necessarily what Bonds are looking for.
Are still recovering from their whole, you know, no longer making stuff in Australia. That, you know, they moved their headquarters, that kind of thing, from last year, and you know, so that's two year on, they seem to be getting slammed every time, and you know, the Bonds Facebook page should have been heavily moderated. I mean, that should have been jumped on straight away. If you see comments like that, if you run a competition like that where it's in the public domain, you need to watch it. You need to watch it hard. I mean, you need to make sure the moment something like that pops up, that's a story waiting to happen.
Time for Bonds to ring Sue Kato again, I think. Next, CommBank's new family.
Commonwealth Bank this week launched a bunch of webisodes centred around fictional Aussie family, the Harringtons. Let's play a clip.
Forget it! Andrew, come in here. Come in, mate. Everyone, this is Andrew.
Hello, Andrew.
Hi, everyone.
Hi. Carol and I have been seeing Andrew for almost 10 years now.
10 years? Will there be a cake?
He's our financial planner.
I just looked at Steve and thought, what's going on?
As if it's not bad enough having to come here to Rogers on a Sunday. And now he goes and wheels out his financial plan. I mean, who else has he got hiding here? Brings out his timeshare buddies again, I'm out of here.
We're in the timeshare too, honey.
Get my point?
What about the barbecue?
Yes, Tony, there'll still be a barbecue.
Pork and fennel. They're not cheap.
Look, I think what Tony's trying to say is, why is Andrew here?
Well, look around. Carol and I are having a wonderful, comfortable retirement. And sure, we've worked hard, but a lot of the credit has to go to Andrew.
It's been criticised on Umbrella of another bank portraying its customers as ignorant morons. Tim, a bit harsh?
Yeah. Firstly, I'm not, although I used the phrase myself in our story and obviously here in the script, I'm not totally comfortable with the idea of calling these things webisodes. I just think that's a twee name that people have made up, really. Personally, I quite like the approach. This idea that, you know, it's not just about 30-second ads for financial planners. You've got to do something to kind of entertain. Bit cheesy, but high production values, some laughs. At the time we published the story, I didn't know the full story on who was behind it because they hadn't done any PR at all. I just stumbled on it on YouTube. Turns out the agency behind it was the White Agency, and the director was Dan Illick, who was involved in Hungry Beast for the ABC, for instance, and, you know, has made a few ads. He did the Don't Be a Dickhead ads from the Victoria Road Safety stuff as well. So I must admit, I'm quite a fan of his work. So it, maybe for that reason, my view was kind of coloured a bit. I thought it was a kind of refreshing new approach. Some of the Umbrella comments to me has been really mean.
Really?
But others were very positive about it as well, you know, as a new approach.
I'm honestly not a fan of them, of these web episodes from CommBank, to be perfectly honest. I just felt like 5 minutes of my time, you know, and then each 3 minute episode afterwards just feels as though, I know they're going for this modern family bent, but I just felt as though it was too much. It felt too copied. It wasn't as funny for a start, you know. I mean,
Yeah, but fair enough. I mean, Modern Family would have a desk of 11 or 12 writers.
Just come back. They just made, what, $3.4 billion in profit? I think they've got enough to play around with here. Get a team of good writers in.
To get a team of writers for something that's only going to go up on the web.
Why not?
And have, you know, where success is...
Doesn't have to be 11 writers.
Yeah, but success is measured on the web in a few thousand rather than a few million views.
Well, look, I just think it was... Look, good on them for trying something new. I just don't think they did it well. Philips, for instance, in Europe, run this excellent campaign, and it was a little web episode. I think they were 9 minutes a piece, and it was a guy from Philips, or one of their marketing guys or something, who was basically had to stand at the side whilst a woman, you know, did a TV show about the products, and he kind of fell in love with her and kind of tried to get a date and all this kind of stuff. And it's this little romantic comedy that runs over it's over 9 episodes. It's really, really well done. And it's funny, and you kind of feel for the guy. He's an English bubbling fool kind of guy. Whereas I just felt they felt too cliched. Everybody in the family just felt too much. And you know, and it's obvious that they just jumped onto the Modern Family bandwagon.
Well, yeah, I think bank brands should really be about trust. And one of the things I was warned about before I arrived in Australia was banks. They don't have a good reputation.
So much money.
banks here. And did these webisodes make me trust Commonwealth Bank or instill a sort of sense of trust? I'm afraid the answer is no. I did find some bits were vaguely charming, and I applaud the sort of trying to take that tack, but it didn't quite work for me.
Scott. Any other business?
Yeah, there's an interesting one, actually. I got contacted on this week by someone just asked me some advice on Twitter. They work in an organisation. There's somebody who tweets from a personal account.
What sort of organisation is it?
I don't really want to get into the full details about it.
Within our industry, though?
Yeah, kind of on the outskirts type thing. But they've got somebody who tweets a lot. They tweet a lot with the religious. Passages from their religious book, but what I found really interesting about it was they said to me, well, you know, this person checks in on Foursquare,
so they effectively put in the public domain where they work.
So, I mean, I'm a firm believer in church and state, which should be separate. You know, you shouldn't bring.
Although church v state could be a good fight.
Yeah. State would win, and I think that, you know, I'm also not a fan of people just quoting passages from anything, even, you know, quotes from celebrities and slamming them in their Twitter feed all the time. It's quick an unfollow button for me. But the person gave me and said, you know, what do we do? Should we do anything? Should we do nothing? You know,
because it might reflect on their organisation.
Exactly, because you don't actually know how people are going to perceive things. And it's quite an interesting one because...
And what was your advice?
I just said, you know, you can either say to them, well, you can just leave it alone. You know, if there's no harm in anything that's happening, you can do that. Or you can just say, look, we appreciate your personal account. So, you know, if you want, you just don't need to check in at your office. You know, it's just simple, you know, that's it. You don't have to. And it's a funny one because
how far could they go? So if they said, well, actually, I'd like to check in at my office.
Well, there's nothing you could do unless it's in a company's got a social media policy in place. And I think that's one of the keys that a lot of companies fail to have at the moment is a social media policy to say what people can and can't do. I mean, one of the factors is that people have. You know, your work staff are your ambassadors. They're the most important people for you to talk about how good your organization is. So, you know, it's very much getting that social media policy right and getting it to work is the key.
That's all we have time for today. Special thanks go to my co-hosts, Fleischman Hillard, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And Mumbrella's new deputy editor, Robin Hicks.
Thanks, Tim.
Who you'll be hearing lots more from in the weeks to come. The Mumbrella cast was recorded at the studios of CBS Interactive. Production was by Alice Terlikovsky. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle pip.